Welcome to Hedson's Living Histories podcast, capturing and sharing the life stories of people who have used or worked in NHS mental health services in Sussex, following the closure of the old asylums in the 1980s, up to and including the COVID-19 pandemic and its aftermath. By listening to people tell us, in their own words, about their experiences, we explore the complex interplay between mental health and a life well lived. Over the course of a year, Living Histories volunteers have recorded 35 in-depth oral history interviews across Sussex, opening up new ways to reflect on the past, present and future impact of mental health on people's lives. The full interviews will remain sealed for 80 years in the Mass Observation Archive at the Keep, housed in the University of Sussex. But in these podcasts, with the permission of the interviewees, we present some of their memories, experiences and reflections for the first time. You might find some of the stories you hear challenging, as participants talk openly about the difficulties of living with mental ill health. Please be aware that topics including mental health crisis, suicide, abuse and neglect are covered in these episodes. Living Histories celebrates the strength, courage and resilience of people living with mental health problems and those caring for them. Our huge thanks to everyone who told their story. This episode, The Safety of Being Nursed, explores the impact of the major shift in mental health care in the UK over the last century, as it traces the movement from large-scale psychiatric hospitals, such as those once common in Sussex, to more community-based support. It looks at how the closure of asylums, which had often removed people from society for decades, and policy changes including the introduction of the Mental Health Act 1983 and the Community Care Act of 1990, changed people's lives from the 1980s onwards as services shifted to community care. Through stories from both service users and staff, we consider what has been lost, what has improved, and how NHS policy changes have shaped lives in Sussex.
When I came to work at Grayling Well, there was only like three wards that still hadn't been moved out into the community. All of that was really quite exciting. I remember we used to do a community meeting. People were meant to come along from the wards. They had no idea what it meant. What does a community mean to you? They thought it was another house. They didn't know where they were going. Because there were people that had been in Grayling Well in the hospital most of their adult life. So the project was really, I mean, it was so exciting. And it was to think about decoration, because all they were used to was bottle green walls, and telling them that we would take them, I'd take them out and go to shops to have a look at curtains, materials, and I used to bring in my sewing machine, and we'd be making bedspreads and curtains, and the guy from woodwork would put up the artificial, like in Laura Ashley, an artificial window, and you would do the pretty curtains around it, and stenciling, putting stencils on windows, and kind of getting them used to colour and choice.
The patients would all in the mornings get up, all be sat on a toilet, restrained almost on the toilet, and then they'd have their breakfast, and all the huge teapots, milk, sugar and tea, were all made out of the same big teapot. And you'd pour in a line, and they'd have the same breakfast, and they'd wear the same sort of clothing. And you think how, you know, community care and individualised patient care has moved on from those days. But in some ways, they're not so long far away, is it? 40-odd years, really.
I remember going for my interview, it was autumn, and you went up this long drive, and then you had these beautiful trees and gardens, and then you had a couple of nursing homes where staff lived, the social club, you had the church, and then you had the main building. But it was autumn and the leaves were absolutely beautiful and gorgeous.
I remember all of those conversations about, is it really cruel to have somebody leave their home, you know, all they've ever known? And I have, you know, shockingly been to Broadmoor and places, and been introduced to the room where the woman lives, who had been there 50 years, and she'd gone there because she had an illegitimate child, as the story went. You know, there may have been more to it. She might have had some behaviour that society didn't like at the time other than having an illegitimate child, but those people were still around. When I started my training, there were still people where you could see the scars on their head from when they've had lobotomies and leucotomies, and we weren't doing that. But I wrote a letter to a child that was born into our family for them to read when they were 18, and the kind of things I was writing down was about having seen ECT, electroconvulsive therapy, because I'm, you know, at the time I was thinking, oh, I'm not sure about this. Works really, really well for some people, but you know, you're that kind of aware of the times changing and what might become something that people would go, wow, you did that? That's shocking. That's awful. So the person-centred individual care and proper care, not just we're doing it to you, but you know, taking care is really important.
We used to run independent living skills group. You go through a series of different assessments. How do they get up, get dressed, get the shower, bath or whatever, make their breakfast? Then it would be how do they access the community. You see, we practice all of this as well. They go to a laundrette. How do you sort the clothes out, put it into the laundrette, pay the money, go into a coffee shop? They probably were living in their home with their parents or in care homes, but they weren't actually doing a lot of these things independently, you know, and then accessing leisure, going to the swimming pool or learning to go on a bus. That was fascinating with some. One particular gentleman, when I was in Grailingwell, he wanted to go on the bus, and he was a very tall guy, and he used to turn round one way so many times, then turn round the other way. We'd be hiding to see how we got to the bus stop, and then we'd jump in our car to be at the other end to see him getting off at the right place.
You know, people had space to wander, peace in that sense. Historically, there used to be a farm and people could work on the farm. And when I was there, they still had a huge team of gardeners who did all the gardening and brought flowers to the wards. And for some of the patients who were keen on gardening, they could actually go and work with the gardeners and be outside. There was also what was called the IT bit. And IT wasn't technology, it was called industrial therapy. Now, unfortunately, it would be deemed to be cheap labour and stuff, but actually it was run like people were at work. So you went and you had a little interview and you agreed to work and you'd turn up and you'd work the hours. There'd be tea breaks and people did get some remuneration. It wasn't a great deal, don't get me wrong, but actually it did provide some structure for people, and actually people enjoyed that sort of feeling of working. And the people who went there, they weren't forced to go there, they wanted to go there and they enjoyed it. They had a big department attached to the IT bit where you could go and do pottery, and you know, they had a woodworking department, so they'd have people in there making benches and that you could sell, and then were around the hospital as well. And the patients had their own social club. There were activities there during the day as well. People could buy tea and coffee and they could buy a sandwich and they could, you know, chat with other people and that. So it was providing an environment where it was still on the hospital, but people could, you know, get off the ward and have some space and time. And there were some football teams, but that was a bit hit and miss.
There was a whole thing about, you know, when the institutions closed, where did these people go? There was some benefit of it. You know, having respite when you're really tormented and unwell isn't a bad thing. Having time out is not a bad thing. Not for years, and not for having a baby out of wedlock. But, you know, some people, when it was closing, would talk about, I need that quiet, I need that peace, I need that time away. But what I started to see was, you know, as the institutions closed, people were relocated or, you know, rehoused. And sometimes in isolation, where they'd never lived alone, they'd be like the lost, I don't know, lost generation. They'd end up becoming in and out of hospital, in and out, in and out, in and out. They might be assigned a long-term key worker, lead practitioner, care coordinator, or they might not. So they were lonely. definitely from the 80s onwards, people would say I'm going to go and smash a window in the building society because I'm on my own and I can't stand it anymore and I don't feel very well and I've got no money, I haven't eaten for days. And then you see, you get people going in and out the kind of police custody or in and out to A&E. So I saw a lot more of that starting to happen. I felt very sad about it, really.
You were grouped into wards according to where you lived, not your particular issue or sex. And it was a dormitory style, so I was in a female dormitory, but I was with people. I was with geriatric people with dementia. I was with people with Down syndrome who were profoundly depressed. It was full on. But at the same time, I found it very comforting, possibly because I was on that much medication, I didn't know which way was up. But also because it was a group home again. You know, nobody was better than anybody else. I felt very comforted there.
When I worked at Falconhurst, which was the older people's service at the time, I remember just sort of sitting in the lounge. The nurses would be up in their office and there would just be me left in a room full of 20-something people supervising. So for me, that was generally having conversations with people. And I remember a lady sitting there. We were just, I don't know what we were talking about. I think something really everyday, like music, and how she used to like to go out dancing. All of a sudden, these people just came in, these staff, four staff, and she was talking to me about dancing, and we were having a little dance. They came in, one person on each limb carried her out and forcibly injected her because she was dancing with me. And they said that meant she was experiencing psychosis and mania. We're talking about a very slow little... I wasn't in a position to challenge that, and it was just horrific. You know, someone had gone to the window to try and get some air and she's been pinned down by two enormous blokes. And I'm like, what? She was trying to escape. Oh, no, she wasn't. She wanted some air because you haven't even let her in the garden for the last week. What it left me with was this need to try and make things better. And the most important thing for me was to change culture and attitudes of the workers.
Big hospitals were huge communities and there were generations of families who'd worked there, you know, through the years. And I think that wasn't necessarily helpful because people grew up hearing family members talking ways that were perhaps unpleasant, derogatory, nasty, whatever. People lived on the hospital site in hospital houses and went to the staff social club and all worked together, all lived together and all socialised together. So it was quite enmeshed, which isn't necessarily very good. And, you'd hear people, you know, really not talking very pleasantly about some of the people they were working for and with.
As a teenager, I volunteered in Nethern, big asylum, which is kind of going out towards the South Downs. And it was famed for pioneering art therapy as a way of understanding mental illness. For a short period, I volunteered in the studio where the art therapist practiced. I went to as a community service volunteer to Fairmile, long stay institution in Berkshire. I was there for about 18 months as a live-in volunteer, and then I got a job within the occupational therapy department. It sort of confirmed for me everything that I felt about psychiatry to be a tool of oppression. It was really disgusting the way that people were treated there. The most unbelievable and abject suffering for no good reason. You know, women who were locked up as teenagers spent their whole lives there for having a baby out of wedlock, and a lot of people who come back from war, from the Second World War, First World War even, who'd kind of been destroyed.
I felt there were the forgotten people in many ways. They'd been put in asylums, weren't really seeing people, seeing their families, and that was their home, that was their life, you know. I mean, I would sit in ward rounds and have great empathy for the patients. And I'm not saying other people didn't, but I mean, we were tasked with the job of allowing them to cook their own breakfast. You know, we wanted a tablecloth with cups and saucers, because everything used to be brought in on a big trolley. They'd stand at the trolley and they'd just do that and then walk off. No, this is to sit down, this is to socialise. But it didn't go down well with ward staff at the time, because we were trying to do something different.
Other people who were residents there said the closure of Grainingwell was horrific for these people. Absolutely horrific. People had no idea what was to become of them. They knew nothing else in their lives at all. And they just got dispersed. The people who had been long-term stay, they just went into care homes, just deteriorated. I didn't see them. It's only the people who were able to come out who were able to mix in the community. I don't know if you realise there are care homes that specialise in people with mental health difficulties in Bognor, all around, people who reside in them. There's a very, very good one in Selsey. That's the sort of places these people went to, and they weren't seen again.
The older generation of people that were living at Helinlai, and I use that word, living at Helinlai, it was their home because they'd been there for such a long time. They came to Amberstone, and some people were moved into the community, into residential homes, and some came here, and they were rehabilitated back to community placement. And I can recall some people moved over to Hastings Way, and some years later they were still there, but there was opportunities for us, when I say us organisationally, to work with those people to move them on out of the residential homes into alternative placements. And that did happen, probably 10 years later than what it should have done, but it did happen, and they did go on to live in a different lifestyle to living in institutions.
I started working in day support in Aldrington House. That was all around when community care started coming in, and the day support centre was open 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. And it was self-referral, and it was a space for people to come and spend the day. We did lots of activities, we provided support. The kitchen was staffed and people could come and get tea and coffee and lunch and an evening meal. So we had people who were living in local residential care homes and supported housing, but also independently or with family or with friends. And that was an amazing experience, because it was, in some respects, replicating what some of them have been used to, having been in the big hospitals, you know, St Francis and Helinglai, and that sort of kind of social group contact. But also it enabled them to be able to come out and go somewhere safe and have a cup of tea and have a natter and play pool and snooker. You could help them see the transition from adult inpatient into living in the community, but there was still contact and support when they needed it. It was enabling them to take charge, responsibility, to not feel that, you know, they were becoming unwell again. But we've lost, I think, anything like that. There now aren't really any day centres or day support for people with mental health problems. It's about, you know, we're trying to encourage people to access generic community services. And that's fine, and it should be, because it shouldn't be exclusive to one group or not another group. But by the same token, there are times when people don't necessarily want to be with people who aren't aware or understanding of their own particular needs.
I was very, very lucky, but when I was discharged from Westbourne, I was discharged with a support worker. Then I lived in a shared women-only house for women recovering from mental health problems. Every morning somebody from BHT would come in and do almost like a firm meeting in the morning just to check that everybody, you know, was sticking to the rules, as in, you know, no drinking, no drugs, no whatever, to check we were managing our budgets. That's it. Weekly, we would have a one-to-one to check we were okay with our money, our health, all those things that are really, really essential to help get you going. I could deal with the care in the community, as it were, because it existed. I got it. But I had other friends who, because they were slightly more difficult to work with because of their problems, you know, it's not that they were horrible people, you know, they were denied the right kind of assistance. But that's the nature of mental health. You could say that I just knew how to play the system better. What happened was Westbourne closed, and the next time I needed help, I had to go to Millview. It was very different. It was hard to get in. You know, I had to go through A&E instead of through my GP. One was made to feel that you had to turn up with the police if you were going to get taken seriously. If you just took yourself up there, you'd just be ignored. The faith in being looked after, the bottom started to fall out of that.
I had a plan at the end of the working day to end my life that day, and it turned out that two colleagues from work ended up intercepting that plan, and I was taken from there in an ambulance to A&E, to like the psychiatric liaison. I remember having a mental health act assessment, my parents being called there. I seemed to make a lot of nurses cry at that time. The psychiatric liaison nurse, she put it to me, do I think I need to go into hospital because it doesn't sound like things are working out in the community.
So I was referred to the crisis team, and they came out, and I was admitted literally within, must have been 24 hours, and I then spent the following nearly 2 years in Millview. I was treated so well, and I was so ill when I went in, and in denial, and, you know, all the things that... I was determined to kill myself as well. And I was just treated with such kindness. You know, Millview isn't... it's not cosy. It's, you know, none of the things that I guess I might have been a bit romantic about in the past. But it's really good at holding people, and that's the staff, that the fact that the doors are locked, you know, that element of feeling safe when you're not safe in your own head, you know, that element of being safe in an institution, it's absolutely priceless, and no amount of community care can replace that. And this whole business of, I would say, the Tory thinking of people have got to be responsible for themselves, and we're going to help people take responsibility and be independent. You are cursing a lot of people then to loneliness and death. And not just death, but real suffering. Because the safety of just being nursed. People have always been nursed. It's not a new thing. It's not a socialist thing. It's a human imperative that we have to nurse each other. You know, you might become institutionalised. I was there for a long time. But there's nothing wrong with that. And actually, what is wrong with some of those old school asylums where people did live for years? If they're happy, you know, that kind of care, it's not, it shouldn't be a dirty word.
There were no NHS beds available, and I was told I was being sent to a private out of area bed. So I was told I got a bed at the Priory North London, and I was taken in the middle of the night by secure transport. Worst day of my life. I remember there was these big marble pillars outside the front of the hospital that is quite a grand building, and I was taken into what was my room. I'd never really stayed in a hotel that had sort of all this plush furnishings and silk sheets on the bed, and I was very confused, and I just felt, what on earth has happened here? I just felt like something's gone really wrong. Like, what on earth am I doing here? The matron, I remember her saying something like, couldn't they have found somewhere else for you? So, well, I didn't really have a choice, did I? I don't want to be here at all.
I've seen a lot of services around here close down. There was a service called Aldington House, which was a drop-in service for people with mental health problems. It was ideal. It attended to people with long-term mental health problems who needed to have access to something when they were struggling, but also provided a social aspect and diversion. And it was closed down because it cost a bit of money. No one would tell me otherwise. And then over the years, I saw those people. I used to see them sometimes in the street and they'd call out and say hello. And eventually, over the years, it's a truthful story, I'd see them and I'd always go and speak, and then they'd say, you know, who died? So-and-so died, so-and-so died, so-and-so died. Obviously, some of them were getting older, but not all of them were that old. Living with secondary health problems, physical health problems, living in isolation, poverty-stricken diet, you know. One day I bumped into a guy who was on a bench I'd known for a long time, and he went, "We've nearly all gone." And he said, "We used to meet in George Street, and then we used to meet in a cafe, a cheap cafe, that's closed down. Now we don't have anywhere to go. We used to meet on the bench and now they're gone." And I just thought, that's not right. In the closing of the institutions, we kind of created people. We put them in those settings, made them dependent, isolated them from a community, de-skilled them, and then discharged them. Horrible. Alienated, over-medicated, lost. A lost generation, I'd say. And then the kind of primary services started to close down, beds started to be closed. I hold that story. It's an important part of the story that I need to say. It doesn't feel right.
I think it's almost like a buzzword nowadays. If somebody doesn't feel very well, it's because of their mental health. You have to sort of sort out. And we do get inappropriate referrals still. Somebody's had a breakup and feel quite suicidal. That hopefully isn't going to be long term, and is it the right service to bring someone into secondary mental health? Maybe at the time to get them through the crisis, but not long term. If somebody's stable, the idea is they would be referred back to the GP. Gone are the days that you're supposed to keep people on indefinitely. That was hard for people who had always had that safety net of being open to the mental health team.
I think some of the things we've lost is the provision of safe space for people. There will always be people who struggle to manage their well-being and need support with all aspects of daily living and find it difficult to make safe choices, keep themselves safe and not be exploited. And I think some of the hospitals enabled people to be off the ward, going out, whereas now I think everything is so restricted because of finances and accessibility, and that I think that immediacy in terms of choice has gone. And I think some people struggle to live in busy places, and the settings of the old hospitals allowed it sort of a space of peace and calm and tranquility. And I think we forget that some people will always need help.
The idea is that you have to think, when you bring somebody in, that they have to be aware that it's not going to be forever. It might be time limited. You work on what the problem is today. Mind you, when you start to work on it, you realise there's probably dozens of problems, but that's the idea.
We are in the process of opening up a new hospital, Coombe Valley, and that's been an amazing journey. We've involved so many people in the design of that. You know, from a clinical perspective of caring for somebody in a hospital, having the lens of a nurse to share what would be helpful, the lens of a person that has to stay and sleep in those hospitals, and the combination of everybody's thoughts with the architects to develop what I think is going to be a really, really great place to work in and to experience your treatment in.
It's very, very exciting. And it will be, you know, a really nice hospital. We wanted it to feel nice and feel homely. The worst time of somebody's life is when they need to go into a hospital, whether it's a general hospital for emergency surgery or a mental health hospital for emergency mental health care. You've just got to make that journey as comfortable as possible. You know, the rooms are really as comfortable as they can be. Everybody's got a window seat so that they can see into a garden, so supportive of the tranquility of hopefully having some personalised space, but also seeing nature and seeing the world outside without feeling like you're cooped up in a ward.
There's no reason to have services like that, is there? I mean, if people go on the wards now, it's for a period of time with the aim to discharge when somebody's stable. So, well, you don't want asylums, but who knows? What goes around comes around, don't they always say that? Close everywhere down and then they all open up again.
In this episode, you'll have heard reference to the closure of Aldrington House at a point in its history when it was being used as a drop-in service for people with mental health difficulties. Over time, like many NHS mental health buildings, Aldrington House has been used for different mental health services, some of which have moved into alternative buildings or the voluntary sector. It continues to be used as a clinical building today, housing specialist eating disorder services. This episode of Heads On's Living Histories podcast was produced as part of a collaboration between Heads On and Sussex Partnership NHS Foundation Trust. Living Histories was funded by the National Lottery Heritage Fund, NHS Charities Together and Heads On. We're deeply grateful to all the participants who shared their stories and to the many staff, volunteers and project partners have made Living Histories possible. If you found this episode interesting and would like to hear more, please visit www.headsoncharity.org/histories, where you can learn more about Living Histories and listen to other episodes. If you've been affected by anything you've heard in this episode, support is available. Please visit www.sussexpartnership.nhs.uk/your-mental-health/getting-help. Audio production by Charlotte Petz and Michael Umney. Music by Chad Crouch. Narration by Living Histories volunteer Ian Barnett. Oral history clips taken from full interviews with project participants from across Sussex for Heads On's Living Histories. For more information about Heads On's other projects, please visit www.headsoncharity.org.